Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we have with us two very special guests in the investment management space, Karen Barr from the Investment Advisor Association and Lisa Crosley from the National Society of Compliance Professionals to discuss the current state of the investment advisor industry, what new regulations are impacting investment advisors and maybe on the horizon for 2024, and other priorities both organizations are focusing on throughout the year. In our headline section, we look at a new FinCEN proposal to include investment advisor in the definition of financial institution under the Bank Secrecy Act. And there was a new FAQ published for registered investment advisors relating to the new SEC marketing rule. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of History Has Your Back, where we revisit a famous quote from a tennis legend to provide us with some inspirational words heading into Form ADV season. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, FinCEN recently proposed to include the term investment advisor in the definition of financial institution under the Bank Secrecy Act. The proposed rule would require advisors to implement AML, CFT programs, and maintain record-keeping requirements. The proposed regulations would amend BSA Rule 1010.100T under the general definitions defining the term investment advisor to include SEC registered investment advisors and investment advisors that report to the SEC as exempt reporting advisors. The proposed rule would require registered advisors and exempt reporting advisors to implement an AML CFT program, file suspicious activity reports or SARs with FinCEN, keep records relating to the transmittal of funds, also known as record keeping and travel rule, among other obligations. The proposed rule would also apply information sharing provisions among FinCEN, law enforcement, government agencies, and certain financial institutions, and would subject investment advisors to the special measures imposed by FinCEN pursuant to Section 311 of the USA Patriot Act. Said FinCEN Director Andrea Gacki, quote, "The current patchwork of AML CFT requirements creates regulatory gaps that criminals and foreign adversaries exploit to launder money, hide illicit wealth, and compromise American innovation. This proposed rule would level the regulatory playing field, protect U.S. economic and national security, and safeguard American businesses," end quote. Comments on the proposal are due 60 days after publication in the Federal Register. And also, please note that in our upcoming interview with Karen Barr and Lisa Crosley, that interview was recorded just days before this rule proposal was made public. And as you might expect, Karen Barr did correctly predict that this rule proposal would be forthcoming shortly. Moving to our next headline, on February 6, 2024, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission issued an updated FAQ for investment advisors related to SEC Rule 20641, the marketing rule, and specifically focusing on the reporting of gross and net performance within advertisements. Under the new FAQ, the SEC staff noted that while the marketing rule does not prescribe a specific methodology or calculation for performance, in situations where gross and net performance returns are used by an investment advisor, net returns must be calculated, quote, over the same time period and using the same type of return and methodology as gross performance, end quote. The staff went on to note in the new FAQ that certain investment advisors to private funds may wish to present a gross internal rate of return for an investment from that time that such investment is made, using capital call lines or other similar borrowing, but excluding the effect of such credit facilities in the calculation of gross IRR, while then presenting the net internal rate of return calculated from the time that investor capital is called to repay the borrowing that was used to make the investment. The FAQ further notes for advisors to private funds that where gross IRR and net IRR are used in an advertisement, it would violate the marketing rule to present gross IRR without the impact of the applicable borrowing compared only to net IRR that is calculated with the impact of the borrowing as it would present IRR calculations being made across different time periods. And two, it would further violate the provisions of the marketing rule requiring presentations of performance in a format designed to facilitate comparison between gross and net performance. The staff essentially concluded that if an advertisement were to show gross IRR commencing from a time prior to the time that capital commitments were called from investors, net IRR must be presented from the same initial time frame. Finally, the staff also noted that an advisor would violate the general prohibitions of the marketing rule if net IRR were presented, including the impact of fund-level subscription facilities, without including either net IRR without the impact of such facilities or providing appropriate disclosures describing the impact of such facilities on the net performance shown. Essentially, if you're using a credit facility associated with a private fund, you need to be sure that your performance calculations are going to be lining up in a way where both gross and net performance match the potential use of that credit facility, or take into account when money would be called, would actually be called from those investors. And if you aren't able to do that for whatever reasons, you need to make sure that you have the appropriate disclosures in place that would describe the impact of having the credit facility and the enhanced performance that it may generate. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am incredibly pleased to welcome back to the show two fantastic women that we had on last year to really do a deep dive into the investment advisor space and the compliance space. And so joining me here again today, I have Ms. Karen Barr from the Investment Advisor Association and Lisa Crosley with the National Society of Compliance Professionals. Karen and Lisa, thank you so, so much for coming back on the show this year. We had such a wonderful conversation last year. We decided to do a little bit of a redo with you again this year. And one of the things that I think is so special and unique about this particular show that we've done together is both of your organizations do such fantastic work in the investment management space proper. But maybe just to kind of kick things off, and maybe for some of our new listeners who may not have heard last year's show, maybe I'll ask you just to do a real quick intro on your specific role and just a quick background on each of your respective organizations. So maybe Karen, I will kick it over to you first.
Sure. And thank you for having me again, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be on the program with you and Lisa again this year. The Investment Advisor Association is the trade association for fiduciary investment advisor firms. Our mission is to advance the interests of the investment advisor community, both on specific policy issues and in the public eye. We work to ensure that there's an appropriate policy environment for investment advisors that's efficient, effective, and protects investors. And we provide resources, education, and opportunities for members to discuss best practices. We've been at this for 85 years, not me personally, although it feels like it. We have almost 600 investment advisory firms that are members of all shapes and sizes, from the largest asset managers in the world to the smaller shops that represent the core of our industry and everyone in between. They serve all kinds of individual and institutional clients and funds and all kinds of vehicles and strategies. And what they all have in common, large and small, is that they're responsible for managing other people's money and helping their clients achieve their life goals and fulfillment.
Thank you for that background, Karen. That was excellent. And without maybe even me really giving you like a softball, you did a fantastic job alluding to some of the stuff I think we'll talk about a little bit later when we talk about the state of the investment advisor industry and kind of the snapshot of what that makeup of registered investment advisors looks like. Ms. Lisa Crosley, I would love to hear from you about the National Society.
Sure. Thank you, Patrick, for having Karen and I back. It's always a pleasure. So NACP is a little bit different of an association. We are a professional membership association. And so versus IAA, which is a trade association. The association was started in 1987, primarily focused on the investment advisory space. It was created to for advisors to have a way to network and connect and educate each other. It has grown over the past 36 years with, we also serve as broker dealers, private funds, investment companies. We have service providers such as law firms, consultants, and companies that offer tech solutions for compliance professionals. Where we're a little bit different than IAA is that we focus strictly on the compliance professional, providing them most educational resources, support where they need it, advocacy and engagement. And so those are the four pillars of the association. When we are meeting with regulators, we try to explain to them that we're the boots on the ground, we're the first line of defense with, you know, for the SEC. So we spend a lot of time trying to cross-educate the regulators. And then at the same time, we're also working with our members, which are also primarily individuals and small firms. We do have the larger firms also, but those that are really in need to have that outlet and connection with their similar firms in a similar space. So this is why we do offer networking opportunities with IA Forum, BD Forum, Private Fund Forums. So there is an opportunity to hear what is going on in those spaces and also to network with others in those spaces.
That's great. That's great. And thank you for that description as well. I think one of the things that I heard in both of your kind of quick responses there and thinking about the, you know, both organizations that I personally love, being someone who's obviously very involved in the space, is this idea of community, right? And with the IAA, it is the community of those that are, you know, providing services in that trade. And on the NSCP side, it's those that are kind of practicing the specific trade inside of those firms doing compliance, right? And you build these fantastic communities that really help lift each other up in a lot of different ways. And so maybe that's a good kind of segue into that first topic to talk about the investment advisor community specifically. And I know one of the things that the IAA has done for many years now is really take kind of a snapshot, right, of the investment advisor industry and, you know, where it stands now, how it's been growing over the years, and the different kinds of, you know, characteristics, right, that might even make up kind of your prototypical firm. But then also, you know, if you look out on the horizon, where are some of the challenges? What are some key focus areas from some of the primary regulators in that space? And so maybe we'll start with Karen. I would love to hear from you a little bit about the most recent investment advisor snapshot and kind of the a little bit about the state. You know, when you all performed that survey, what were some of the specific parts of the numbers that you got back that you know kind of stood out to you?
Sure. Well, as you know, we do a snapshot of the industry every year, and it's very comprehensive. We download all of the Form ADV data every April. So it's based as of the latest updates, March 31, the annual update. And we slice and dice all of the data from Form ADV Part 1 related to every SEC registered investment advisor. So it's 85 pages that you can really sink your teeth into. So I'm just going to provide a few headline statistics here. Perfect. Our industry is growing and thriving. So despite everything that's been thrown at it over the last several years, the number of SEC registered investment advisors keeps going up. Last year, it grew 2% to 15,114 investment advisor firms, managing $114 trillion in AUM, which actually, it's a huge number. It's actually down year-end 2022 compared to year-end 2021. And the data is based on year-end because that's the Form ADV data.
Right.
It's an industry that employs a lot of folks in their home communities. So there are 971 plus thousand employees, non-clerical employees of SEC registered advisors, but it's really a small business community. So 91.7% have 100 or fewer employees, and more than half of all SEC registered advisors have 10 or fewer employees. So this is really strongly a small business community. And we spend a lot of time making sure that the regulators understand that, and we'll get to that, I know, later. One of the things that I do want to point out is that the number of advisory clients is growing. 61.9 million investment management clients. Clients more and more are seeing the value of fiduciary advice and gravitating toward our space. 91% of investment advisors manage money on a discretionary basis. So they don't just give recommendations, they're actually managing portfolios. And 62.8% provide asset management services for individuals as opposed to institutional clients. So it's interesting. It's a dynamic industry. There's lots of consolidation, but there are also a lot of new entrants.
Yeah.
And I could dig deeper, but I would love to hear your thoughts.
Well, no, I mean, all of those numbers that you provided, I think, do help provide and round out some kind of help us wrap our arms around who actually is in the space. But there are a couple key items in there that I do want to dig into. And one, it would seem to me, if you're having the number of advisors going up every year and you continue to have the number of clients being served that are going up every year, there does seem to be kind of a movement, right? I mean, I think you maybe even have used those words of that there's been a continued movement and upward shift of people really appreciating that fiduciary level of advice that they get and moving towards that kind of an arrangement with their financial advisor. Do you sense that too from your members, of the IAA? Do the democratization almost of a lot of the folks that are getting kind of wealth management or investment advisory services? Are you seeing that in your role at the IAA and with your kind of broader membership?
Absolutely. Our members see the number of clients going up, and they are offering, and I think part of what is assisting that is not only external factors such as the volatility of the markets and the complexity of the options and those external factors that are leading more folks to want to seek fiduciary advice, but also investment advisors are expanding their modes of service to clients. They're offering new and different kinds of advisory services. They're offering additional ways to pay. So for example, there are more fixed fee and subscription arrangements. There are a lot of folks who are offering hourly financial planning, for example. There's digital advice. So there are more options for clients to connect in different ways with investment advisors.
Yeah. Another thing that you mentioned that I'd love to dig into and maybe even ask Lisa kind of a question on is, you talked about the size of the folks that are in the investment advisor space. And certainly, of course, there are going to be some giant folks that are out there. But you talked about how more than 90% of RIAs employ 100 and fewer employees. And just in reading the snapshot myself, a couple other things in that kind of industry of small business section near the top, it talks about 70%, I should say more than 70% of advisors manage less than $1 billion in assets under management, and 88.5% manage less than $5 billion, and advisors focused on individuals. So, those folks that are often considered wealth managers are going to have an average of just 9 employees, 2 offices, and around 330 million assets under management. And so, I would love to kind of hear, from you, Lisa, and thinking about some of the compliance professionals that are serving in that capacity at those firms. There's obviously been a kind of a deluge of rulemaking and other stuff that's come out over the past couple of years from the SEC. Mm-hmm. But in reality, so many of these firms, they may not have the kinds of resources that a really large you know, investment advisor or other financial advisor participant might have. Do you sense that among your membership that there's a strain of resources from the compliance perspective, especially when you have so many of these types of investment advisors being built as small businesses?
We definitely do. I mean, first off, I want to say that we've seen quite a bit of contraction on the BD side, and our investment advisor membership has gone up. But similar to IAA's members, they're small firms, and you know, 10 or less, 15 or less. And all this past year, the calls that I've received as, you know, I can't keep up with the regulations. What are your recommendations? And my question back is, where do you need the most help? So that's where NSCP, we started with working groups for having, you know, outside counsel who's volunteered to help guide, you know, gratuitously guide NSCP members into sort of the, like the marketing role working group. How should you approach implementing that role? So we've really had to go down to a different educational level, more heightened educational level versus just having an event and discussing it or having a panel session. So we've seen that quite a bit. We've advocated quite a bit with the SEC concerning the time constraints and the not only that, the human resources and financial resources constraints that the proliferation of roles and promulgation of new roles has brought to the investment advisor industry. Also, the broker-dealer side, a little quieter, but they too have, if they're dual registrants, they've been impacted also.
So staying on that advocacy part, and Karen, you mentioned something in your response a moment ago that I wanted to follow up on, which is, you know, you were talking about how, given the size of so many of your members and the size of kind of the typical registrant that's in this space and the kinds of, again, resources that they might be able to bring to bear versus other much larger firms, you talked about trying to kind of work with regulators and meet with regulators to help remind them of that. What are some of the ways that the IAA is doing that now, you know, in working with regulators to, again, kind of continue to remind them of, look, these are the people that are actually doing the work, and these are the people that are going to have to kind of answer the bell when you throw out all these new rules or all these different obligations and requirements on them. So, you know, what are some of the ways that you're able to help do that for those that are in the investment advisor space?
We hammer this message home in every comment letter that we write to the SEC. Every comment letter, we talk about the impact of the proposal on smaller advisors. And in every meeting with the SEC staff, with the commissioners, with SEC Chair Gensler, we talk about the impact on smaller advisors. We bring in our members to talk with folks at the SEC to discuss what the impact of these rules are on them, and also some of the unrealistic expectations that the rules inherently include. So for example, a lot of the proposals assume that investment advisors can negotiate with service providers for certain terms and conditions. And that isn't just a ridiculous assumption. Most investment advisors have zero leverage over the service providers. And to assume that investment advisors are going to be able to negotiate these terms and conditions in all of these proposals is really unfounded. We've also worked on Capitol Hill to make sure that members of Congress understand the small business nature of our industry. And in fact, we promoted legislation that would force the SEC to change their definition of small business so that they really have to take it into account better in their cost-benefit analysis in their rulemaking proposals. So if listeners haven't written their member of Congress, I'm happy to provide the link, or maybe there's a link in the podcast that I can give you, Patrick. It's very important to let folks know that they need to advocate on this issue.
And I just want to say we appreciate that advocacy. Your advocacy inherently helps NSCP members, especially on that issue. And so I just wanted to add one thing, one that we did a little bit differently than this year. It was always when I was a CCO, I never understood why there was an educational bridge between the SEC and the compliance professionals. And I was fortunate this year to get the ear of Marshall Gandy, who is the associate director of the Division of Examinations, and to discuss that. And I said, how about if your staff came to our conference to sort of get an inside look at what compliance professionals and those that serve them, service providers, are grappling with. And they did take me up on it, and we worked with Richard Best and the rest of the examination staff. And the feedback we got was that it did open their eyes, and they were able to talk to compliance professionals and speakers and learn themselves. And that we need more of that type of dialogue with regulators too, in terms of the education, and so we're on the same page. And so we only can hope that we'll get better in the future.
That's right. Well, as someone who works with many investment advisors of all shapes and sizes, large and small, let me thank you both for the hard work that both of your organizations are doing to continue to improve that dialogue between and that advocacy between those that are in the investment management industry and those, you know, specifically that are working on the compliance side of the house. I know that all of those firms are definitely benefiting from that work. Speaking of that work, let's talk about maybe some of the things that we mentioned a moment ago. The SEC has been really busy over the last, since we last chatted, even back in early 2023. So I know, you know, on the, there's been many different rulemakings over the past several years that certainly, you know, continue to garner some headlines. And I know, you know, again, even just you kind of mentioned it a moment ago, Karen, that, you know, all the folks at the IAA are continuing to obviously keep a really keen eye on some of these different policy initiatives that are happening. As it relates to some of the rule proposals that we've seen kind of come out over the last couple of years, maybe I would love for you to maybe highlight a couple key ones that you see potentially, you know, maybe provide an update on some of those. So maybe like PDA analytics, cybersecurity, always something that people are continuing to talk about. Custody, and then there's still kind of looming out there this, you know, service provider, third-party service provider rule. So maybe, I don't know, just to kind of start with those for you, certainly feel free to add to that, although that's a good healthy amount. Maybe would love to hear from you on what you're hearing as it relates to some of those different proposed rulemakings that are out there.
Sure. And obviously we could spend all day if we went through all the rule proposals out there.
Right.
But just starting with the predictive data analytics proposal, it's a proposal addressing conflicts of interest associated with use of predictive data analytics by advisors and brokers in investment interactions. That sounds targeted, but it's way broader than that. As set forth in the proposal, it really is a misnomer. It's not just focused on predictive data analytics. It's focused on every single technology in every single format that any advisor might use that might directly or indirectly involve investor interactions. It includes algorithms, models, spreadsheets, classic financial planning software that most advisors use. So it's a very, very broad proposal. And under the proposal, advisors would have to engage in an extensive process, not only to identify all the conflicts, including foreseeable conflicts, but they're also required essentially to document why there isn't a conflict if there isn't one or foreseeable. So it's a very problematic proposal. We are strongly opposing it. We've asked the SEC to withdraw it. I think the most troubling thing about it is that it's moving away from the principles-based framework of fiduciary duty under the Advisors Act and has created a whole separate framework. Doesn't make any sense. And it also just misses the mark on AI, right? So it's overbroad, but it's also in some ways too narrow. I mean, it doesn't really cover the emerging technologies that they're actually really concerned about. So we've had numerous meetings with the SEC on this. And we understand that they're still in process. This one, our understanding is they're still taking meetings. They're still under consideration. This one is not imminent, unlike perhaps some of the other proposals.
That's good. That's good. You echoed, we had Dahlia Bloss actually come on the podcast earlier in the year, I should say late last year in 2023, to talk about the rules. And everything that you just articulated were some of the same kind of concerns and challenges that she had mentioned on that show as well.
The rule has been pretty universally panned, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
We thought they should withdraw it. So they, I don't think it's even that fixable. They should start again, honestly.
Yeah. What about on the cybersecurity front? There's been a little bit of chatter, right, over the past few months about the cybersecurity rule, which I believe the original proposal came out in February of 2022, I want to say. Yeah, have you heard any updates on that rule proposal?
Well, so that one got a little bit delayed also because they reopened the comment period when they proposed Regulation SP on data privacy. And actually, we took the opportunity to submit an additional comment letter, and I know they got a number of additional comment letters on cybersecurity. I'm a little surprised that this one has not come out yet, and it seems to be a little further away than some of the other rule proposals. I think that might be because they're trying to sync it up with a data privacy rule proposal. There was a lot of overlap. And one of the things we said was the SEC should take a step back and look at the rule set holistically. There were some inconsistencies, and not just between the data privacy proposal and the cybersecurity proposal, but also among cybersecurity rules in other contexts. So I think they're taking a good look at it. We have not heard that this one is imminent. We did submit our supplemental comment letter, gave a lot of additional information on the costs and how the SEC massively underestimated the costs of the proposal. We provided data from our members on how much it would cost. Needless to say, it was very different from what the SEC thought it would cost. So hopefully that is giving them pause as well.
Yeah. And then on the custody and the service provider front, you know, this goes back to a comment you actually had made earlier, Karen, which is that the investment advisor has this kind of robust negotiating power when it comes to the kinds of things that they can obligate their custodians or other service providers to agree to, a lot of which was kind of in different parts of the substantive rule proposals there. But what are you hearing on the streets with regard to the custody rule proposal and the service provider rule proposal as well?
So I'll start with the custody proposal. That one would make massive changes to the custody rule. It would expand the rule to cover all assets, including art, real estate, commodities, digital assets. It would eliminate the exception from discretionary trading, which is, you know, as I said, 91% of investment advisors have discretionary trading authority. It would make privately offered securities subject to real-time asset verification and require advisors to enter into written contracts with their clients' custodians. So it would really interfere with the relationship between the clients and their own custodians. It just doesn't make any sense. We submitted a 62-page letter pointing out all of the many problems with the proposal. Again, this one has been pretty universally criticized. There are a lot of problems. We've met numerous times with Chair Gensler, the staff, with commissioners. We brought in all kinds of different kinds of members to talk about the different angles, what this rule would do to different types of advisors with different types of custodians. I do think they're going to take their time and try to fix some of the problems with this rule. I don't believe this one is imminent. It does seem that they're still taking meetings and additional information, and they recognize that there are some issues with the rule that really need to be fixed. That's custody. And with respect to outsourcing, I'm sorry to say that I think this one might be more imminent within the next month or so, is what we're hearing on outsourcing. This one also would require investment advisors to negotiate certain terms and get certain assurances from their third-party service providers. Again, supremely unrealistic and not necessary. I mean, investment advisors are already required under their fiduciary duty to oversee their service providers. So it's unnecessary. We don't think the SEC should proceed with it. But nevertheless, we are hearing that they are going to proceed with it and that it will come out in the next month or so. I think they will make some tweaks around the edges to deal with issues that have been raised. For example, treatment of affiliates as service providers. That's an issue that we raised very specifically with the SEC and wrote a follow-up letter on. I think they appreciate that point. I think they might tweak it in that area. But fundamentally, I think we're going to see it mostly as proposed, and it will be, unfortunately, not too far away.
Thank you for all of that additional insight into all four of those different rule proposals and some of the related timelines. I'm really glad that you mentioned fiduciary duty as it relates to the outsourced kind of outsourcing and service provider, you know, the third party service provider rule proposal, because that was something that, and I think it was both Hearst and Ueda. I definitely remember reading it in Commissioner Hearst's comments that it was duplicative. It was redundant. There's these, you know, we've had these fiduciary rules in place for however long. And part of that includes anytime you as an advisor are hiring some other party to act as your agent in the performance of some duties, you need to make sure that they are able to do so in a way that's going to be acting in the client's best interests. And it's going to meet certain obligations based on your own standard of care, right, that you owe already. And so I certainly am interested to see, because I know, like you mentioned, for some of these other rulemakings, that the comments that were received were robust and that there were some different pushback from the industry. Lisa, from your side, I know that we also had compliance members at the NSCP with regard to some of those different rule proposals that also from specifically like from the compliance officer's perspective, there are many issues with some of these different rule proposals. Anything to add to some of the comments that Karen made there?
Yeah, I think, you know, NSCP did submit comment letters on, we joined on a trade association letter on the PDA analytics, and we did comment individually on custody and service provider. And we too look at the smaller firm and the effect of the rule on the firm. And the feedback that we get from our members is that, you know, it is smaller firm, they're at a disadvantage already. So to get reports from a service provider, I mean, I can just remember when I was in a small firm, it was, you know, I knew I was down, you know, right at the bottom of the pack to get what I needed. So there's a disadvantage there, as well as the, you know, as I said, the financial and, you know, human burden. So we really focus on that. And also just sort of the, how we did talk about fiduciary duties also, and how that, you know, this was already covered. So we're just adding layers and layers on. And what happens with that is that it's in a smaller shop, you're going to, you know, trip on the crack. And so we don't want to see enforcement actions for the sake of enforcement actions because of that.
Right. Well, and think of like all of the different hats that you're asking folks inside of those small firms to wear, including the hat of a chief compliance officer, and what you're asking them to become experts in, you know, from
all right, like exactly the custody role is you know, an example of that, with you know art and, you know, the tangibles. It's like you'd have to have, you know, experts to be covering that section of the custody role. It's just it's not feasible.
Right. No, thank you for that. Let's maybe shift a little bit. And thank you for that recap of kind of some of the outstanding rulemakings that are out there. That's really, really helpful. I think I'd love to spend the last bit of our time together on today's show looking forward in kind of 2024 to some other potential issues that, you know, may not necessarily be on people's radars. And then also maybe dive in a little bit and hear from you both about some of the plans that, that each organization has with regard to some of the kind of organizational initiatives or priorities that you are. But maybe let's start with some potential sleeper issues. So, you know, we've talked about the big ones that are making the headlines, you know, PDA analytics, cybersecurity, custody, et cetera. Karen, what are a couple kind of issues that you're hearing about that maybe haven't been making as much headlines yet, but that you see potentially kind of manifesting themselves throughout 2024?
So I would point to two issues to start that are, I think, not quite on people's radar screen. One of them is anti-money laundering rules for investment advisors. This topic has been discussed for years. The Treasury Department has proposed anti-money laundering rules for advisors for at least twice over the last 20 years and never completed the pass. In Congress 2 years ago, there was legislation that would have required Treasury to impose anti-money laundering rules on investment advisors. And the IA was successful in getting that provision dropped from legislation it was attached to, but it did require Treasury to issue a report on investment advisors. And we have been meeting with Treasury to educate them about what a low risk investment advisors are. But nevertheless, we believe that there will be a focus by Treasury on investment advisors and anti-money laundering at some point this year. So that's one. The other sleeper issue that is, I think, very problematic is that there is litigation in Missouri. Some of you may know that Missouri adopted rules related to disclosures when advisors consider ESG factors in investment decisions. Another trade association, SIFMA, sued Missouri in federal court over those rules, arguing that Missouri is preempted from substantive regulation of broker-dealers and investment advisors. That litigation may actually for the first time squarely raise the interpretation of federal preemption under a law called NISMEA from 1996 that separated SEC and state jurisdiction. Missouri is interpreting preemption supremely narrowly. If they were to win in their interpretation, it would basically eviscerate federal preemption of advisors and open investment advisors up to the 50 state of regulation. So this is an incredibly important case. We plan to file an amicus brief in it, arguing that how we've always interpreted federal preemption with respect to investment advisors for the last 25 years should remain the law of the land and the interpretation. That is that states cannot substantively regulate investment advisors other than a few very narrow items like licensing and payment of fees. So this one is an important case to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When talking about the preemption, we've seen on the definition of fiduciary, the state of Massachusetts recently cited a case that is now going up to the Supreme Court on the issue of preemption for fiduciary duty. I think also too, going back to NISMEA, it initially wasn't covering, you know, private funds. And so it could be like there's the, like issue, it's like privacy laws, your ESG, even AML, those things that you're not thinking about typically, they could come back to, you know, to bite you on the state level. I definitely also think that the Corporate Transparency Act might catch up to some people. That was just adopted January 1st. So that's something to be aware of. And the GDPR privacy rules. I think that any firm doing business overseas really should look at the sanction regime for particular countries, because that seems to be a concern for some of our members.
Yeah. Karen, did you have something to add to that too? I completely agree with both of you. And you know, of the ones you mentioned there that, again, I can immediately see causing a bit of a headache for some of the folks in the space. I mean, that preemption one, just, I mean, when you start to think about how much advisors and even kind of the way that they conduct business with their clients, the fact that many of them are moving out of their local geographic region very frequently to provide services all over the country in so many different states. I mean, the kind of impact that then being subject to the substantive state law, like Karen had mentioned, outside of licensing or outside of a couple of those key areas where they have a direct nexus to that state because they're either domiciled there or that's where they work out of or that's where the residents that they're prospecting with are from. Man, that could cause some pretty significant challenges to a lot of different firms out there. Let's maybe turn to you, Lisa. I'd love to hear, you know, I know the NSCP, you know, continues to, again, provide such fantastic services for its compliance members and those folks that are tasked with running the compliance programs inside many of these different investment advisor firms. What are some of the, you know, 2024 kind of, you know, organizational initiatives or other kinds of priorities that the NSCP is looking at for the upcoming year?
So in our board that's deciding on our strategic plan, really wanted the staff to help, you know, focus on community and engagement. And the best way to do that is work with your volunteers. Many of our volunteers are at small firms and their, you know, managers, you know, or executive management doesn't have time to work with them on the skills, professional development skills to help you in your career growth. And so we are looking to formalize our volunteer development program from the first time that you volunteer for NSCP through being a board member if you so choose to do that. So having a little bit more education, more touch points, having a dedicated staff person to oversee that process, adding more educational opportunities along the way. So if you're, you know, volunteering on a committee, that's one thing. But if you want to chair a committee, there's different responsibilities. And then if you want to be a board member, we were discussing that we should probably have board orientation before you even get on the board, because so that you know what you're getting into, especially in the association space. Additionally, we're looking to expand staff bit. We're growing, but we do need a little bit more subject matter expertise, especially in the regulatory area. It's been fast and furious, and it would be helpful to us have, you know, those that can help read rules, dissect, you know, distill them down and work with our regulatory advisory committee. And then just general working, you know, with staff, adding to staff as needed. So we've outsourced some things that we think are more efficient being handled by service providers so that staff can focus more on the needs of the members. So that's what we're focusing on this year.
Yeah, that's great. And I can definitely, one, I love the idea of the volunteer development program and kind of the life cycle that you could have as you kind of move through the organization. I definitely think that, especially if you go back and look at the first half of our conversation today, having somebody internally that could help digest some of those rulemakings that you and Karen have been talking about would definitely be, you know, really helpful there. Karen, let's turn to you. I know the IAA, you just mentioned with all the stuff that's going on, I'm sure there's no shortage of stuff to do, but what are some, from an organizational perspective, what are some of the items that the IAA is kind of focused on this year and some upcoming priorities for you all?
Well, obviously continuing on the advocacy front, we have our work cut out for us. We have not given up a single vote on a single issue with respect to any of these topics. One of the things that we'd like to do with respect to our advocacy is not only grow our presence in terms of the breadth of topics that we cover, but in terms of getting our members engaged on a grassroots basis. So getting more folks to come to Capitol Hill, getting more folks engaged with members of Congress. We launched recently an advocacy council, which is kind of the grassroots engine of our membership in terms of getting involved on Capitol Hill, helping set our agenda, helping educate policymakers about investment advisors. So the Advocacy Council is an important initiative for us. Advocacy Day, I'll just give a little plug, June 6th in Washington, obviously. You actually don't even have to be a member to come to Advocacy Day. Anyone can come join us. We feel it's that important. We open it up to everyone. We're also, because of the posture that the rule set is in, we're moving from proposals to final rules. We are enhancing our resources, our resource center for our members in terms of templates, checklists, FAQs, understanding the new rules as they come out, and like Lisa, implementation groups. For example, we just obviously launched a private fund implementation working group for the new private fund rules. We're also launching additional groups to get more different types of members within our firms involved. So a fintech forum for folks within firms for technology. We have an HR group. We have a DE&I group. So groups within for different kinds of individuals within our member firms.
That's great. That's great. And I mean, it sounds like between all of what both organizations have going on, it's going to be an exciting 2024 for both of you all. Lisa, was something you wanted to add to that?
No, I think it's almost the same concept, is we really got to keep hold of our members and be there for them and provide those resources and opportunities to get more involved. And so it's almost hand in hand. It's maybe just a different way we do it, but there's alignment there. And we do have many members that overlap. And so I'll give a plug for NSCP members. Please go to Advocacy Day if you're able. Even if you're not a member, it's very important. We don't do that, but if you're being invited by the Investment Advisors Association, you should go.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Well, and you're right. I mean, there is so much alignment of interest there between the member firms and being able to obviously, from a business perspective, from an organizational perspective, being able to, you know, make sure they are able to help implement these new rulemakings, all these other things that are coming out. And then from the compliance officer's perspective, right, they're going to be the boots on the ground that's really helping to kind of develop a lot of that execution and really help kind of turn the black and white on the paper into, you know, the practical application of that. So absolutely, that's kind of fantastic feedback from you both. Thank you. Well, again, thank you both so, so much. I really appreciate you being so generous with your time to come on and talk about so many important issues that are impacting the investment advisor industry. Thank you for all of your work leading two fantastic organizations and for continuing to make the broader investment management industry that much better. So thank you again very much for coming on today's show.
Thank you for having me.
Look forward to having you both back on here maybe next year.
That sounds great.
It's a pleasure to work with you.
Thank you.
Take care. The final part of today's show features another segment of History Has Your Back. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents the part of the podcast where we go back in time to help us better understand the present and help define where we're headed in the future. In 2008, Billie Jean King wrote a book entitled Pressure is a Privilege, Lessons I've Learned from Life and the Battle of the Sexes. I came across this quote recently and it got me thinking, particularly as we look ahead to the ongoing onslaught of new rules from the SEC likely to come out here in 2024 in the upcoming regulatory filing season. After digging around a bit, I came across an article from Forbes written by Jody Cook in 2021 discussing the quote from Billie Jean King, and I thought I would share that article with you now as an excellent addition heading into that Form ADV regulatory filing season. The title of the article is Pressure is a Privilege. We all feel pressure from time to time. It's butterflies in your tummy before a big meeting or that sinking feeling when confronted with adverse news. It's the adrenaline rush before taking the mic or sleepless nights worrying about what the week entails. It's feeling overwhelmed with all you have to do and wondering if you'll ever fit it all in, but knowing that you need to. Pressure comes in various guises. Here's why it's a privilege. Pressure is a privilege was said often by tennis legend Billie Jean King and has wisdom beyond its simple premise. With 39 Grand Slam titles, she was expected to win. People were counting on her. The weight of expectation might have crushed anyone else, but not King. She knew pressure was her privilege, and she rose to meet it. quote, usually if you have tremendous pressure, it's because an opportunity comes along, end quote. She remembers thinking about the phrase on center court of Wimbledon, realizing that she had been dreaming about this moment and feeling a lot of pressure. Even then, she could appreciate how incredible it was to be standing there. Quote, most of the time, if you really think about it, usually it's a privilege, end quote. What's the alternative? No pressure, no expectations, no records to set, no award-worthy performance, no finding out what you might have been capable of, no chance to serve, no time to shine. The world needs leaders, and you could be one of them, but instead you shy away and look for the easy road. What's the point if no one is counting on you? What's the use in your gifts if you keep them to yourself? They're only watching because they want to see what's next. You have inspiring to do and problems to solve and people to help. So step up and stop complaining. Pressure might crack an egg, but it can also form a diamond. For all of our compliance brothers and sisters out there, I know a lot is being thrown at you right now. I know a lot is being asked of you right now. And now, on top of all of that, let's throw on the fact that Form ADV season is right around the corner, followed by Form PF season for our private fund advisors, followed by the annual delivery of disclosure documents for all advisors. I recognize that there is so much on your plate, but just remember that pressure is a privilege. People are counting on you because that pressure that you feel is an opportunity for you to shine. So what are you made of? And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calfee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Lisa Crosley and Karen Barr, for coming on the show today to discuss the state of the investment advisor industry and share their insights on new regulations impacting the advisor space in 2024. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.